Good morning. It's 8:06 on this Wednesday, January 6th, 16 degrees here in Old Town Park City. Clear skies now. On the phone from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Erica Martin. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. I hope everybody's having a great day today. We are tracking a really nice day in the forecast, including a ridge of high pressure that's continuing to develop. So we do have lots of sunshine for your Wednesday, and the winds will be calm. We're seeing mid-30s for your high temperatures, overnight lows in the upper teens. I'd say about 18, 19 degrees, building clouds by Thursday, second half of your Thursday. Even though it looks like you'll see a few clouds for tonight, I'm going to leave you a partly cloudy for tonight. I just don't see that much moisture creeping into your forecast region. Media Summit, Wasatch County, of course, these things take time as far as moisture goes, but I do have clouds developing on Thursday, mostly sunny to start your Thursday to partly cloudy, and eventually mostly cloudy on Thursday night. A high of 32 on Thursday, overnight lows in the low to mid-teens, about 14 degrees. And on Friday, we're tracking building clouds and a chance of some snow showers for the second half of Friday into early Saturday. A high of 31 on Friday, overnight low 17 degrees, and then keeping it in the upper 20s on Saturday. I'd like to certainly explain that on Saturday, while we will have a quick piece of energy moving through, a shortwave trough, it will bring us some light snow showers, but early. So the second half of your Saturday is going to be just fine with a mix of sun and clouds. And then on Sunday, we have mostly sunny skies. The overnight low on Saturday, however, is going to be pretty cold. We're seeing anywhere between 9 to 10 degrees as your expected high temperature. We may even get to an 8. And then 28 degrees is your expected high temperature on Sunday, overnight lows at about 11, 12 degrees. Building clouds by the second half of your Monday into Tuesday. Now, I don't see any moisture yet making it in. I've looked at the Canadian models. Long-range, medium-range models don't suggest anything other than some increasing cloud coverage, which very well looks like we could see something making it in by Wednesday into Thursday. But apart from the opportunities to see some snow showers Friday into early Saturday morning, it looks like a fairly dry stretch with colder temperatures at night, of course, as to be expected. But for today, enjoy the sunshine.
Thank you. KPCW News Time, 8:08. And with a look in the backcountry and the fun with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, it's Drew. Good morning.
Hey, Leslie. Good morning. This is getting on 22 seasons for me as an avalanche forecaster here at the Utah Avalanche Center. And today has a lot of the hallmarks of when we've seen avalanche accidents in the past. It's just a beautiful, it's going to be a beautiful, glorious day out there. A really light wind, warming temperatures, and just the conditions are ripe for an accident. You know, we've seen, you know, 8 to 10 inches of new snow and some stronger winds, and I think we're building that slab over the weak early season faceted grains, and many of them are just sort of hanging in the balance, Leslie, waiting for a trigger. And I know that a lot of people are hungry for that world-class powder, and no joke, it's out there, but the danger is considerable, and human triggered avalanche is 1 to 2 feet deeper likely. And sort of a word to many of the listeners over on the Park City side, you know, if you're stepping out of the bounds, you're stepping into considerable avalanche danger. And particularly a lot of people out there alone, too, is that if you're alone, your margins are razor thin and you can't make any mistakes. There's nobody out there to bail you out. So word to the wise, excellent riding conditions on low angled slopes. Probably best to stick to those today.
Okay, Drew, thank you. Congratulations on 22 years, too. Impressive.
So, I missed that. Say again?
I said congratulations on 22 years as well.
Well, just at the halfway mark, you know.
Okay.
It's been a good run, Leslie. Thanks so much.
All right, thanks. KPCW News Time now, 8:10. Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with Heber City Council member Heidi Franco, taking a look at what happened at last night's fourth public hearing with regard to the North Village Overlay Zone. Then the Park City Council meeting for the first time of the year. We'll be talking with Park City Manager Matt Dias and Deputy City Manager David Everett, be spending some time talking about the Arts and Culture District and where we go from then. And then tickets to the 2021 Sundance Film Festival go online starting tomorrow. We'll be talking with the Managing Director and CFO of the Sundance Institute, Betsy Wallace. Stay tuned. 8:12 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, the Heber City Council held a fourth public hearing regarding the North Village Overlay Zone last night. On the phone to tell us what happened, I have Heber City Council member Heidi Franco. Good morning, Heidi.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. So the meeting was still going strong at 8:30 last night. Did the council make a decision about when they're going to vote on this?
Actually, we need to wait for Mr. Hardman to decide on that. He was not able to stay at all of the meeting with some health concerns, and we were not able to get his input. He would be the third vote one way or the other. Councilmember Kaler and I are definitely willing to wait. We have some strong concerns about traffic and environmental impacts, as well as the high densities that are being proposed. But Councilmember Johnston and Stack seem to go forward with a few more changes that were discussed after the end of the 3.5-hour public meeting.
So more than 100 people zoomed into the meeting. Dozens of others have weighed in with comments and letters. Input included accolades about the work that's been done in the zone. Most comments, though, did talk about some of the issues you discussed: air quality, traffic, affordable housing, water quality, rural lifestyle, traffic. With 30,000 people expected to move into the development over the next 20 years, how does the NVOZ address these issues?
I worked very hard, Leslie, to make sure the air quality protections are there. There is a wood-burning stove ban in the area. I'm also working very hard with the County Health Department to ensure groundwater protections to the Northfields Aquifer. The Northfields Overlay Zone area is in the medium to high risk area for groundwater pollution into that whole Northfields Aquifer. So I've been able to get the council to agree to not formally adopt with the state the MS4 stormwater standards, but to voluntarily adopt them and to go forward this year in getting an MS4 compliant stormwater management plan for that area. I know the county had high standards with stormwater management, and that seemed to be a sticking point for the developers in asking for their densities or trying to sign master plans, I'm assuming, with the county because of those, you know, needs. It's a sloped area. You can't fight gravity. So that is going to be a big impact, I think, on what's being proposed to have the city do the stormwater. Trying to think of the other environmental protections we have there. I think we need to push for mass transit set-asides. We know that that's likely to come. Let me see. Anyway, those are some of the environmental concerns I've definitely pushed on for the NVOZ.
Yeah, so what would have to happen then to make you feel like the groundwater protection is adequate?
Well, the County Health Department has just completed their groundwater study, September 2020, that I'm referring to. Here we go. One more groundwater protection. I was able to get the council to, at least several on the council, to agree to the private wellhead protections in the NVOZ area because they do feed into the same aquifer that's on the other side of the road in the north field. So if we can now formally and see the final language, we haven't seen it yet, but the final language that will protect the private wellheads, and then the county health department is saying they want to continue to work with the city and the county to study and monitor the groundwater and to make further recommendations as needed in the future. That's a great thing.
So you've expressed that the council is moving too quickly on this. Other council members, of course, say the details can be worked out. So do we need to wait, or do we just start to move forward and get the ball rolling?
I think anyone can see that the amount of negotiation that happened with Sorensen, that Sorensen annexation or any annexation, there's so many, many details in annexations and zone changes and such that I believe the stronger the code is, the easier it is to negotiate on all the other things. I would prefer the NVOZ code to be as strong as possible so that we don't have to negotiate on and on and on, because what happens is fatigue. You saw the fatigue last night. Council members, the city, everyone gets tired and tired and tired of continual negotiations or uncertainty. So to me, it's much better to have the strongest code.
You also expressed a worry about allowing densities that could be sold off or transferred to other developers. So what do you think needs to happen there?
Well, that actually might be a help in the NBAWS. Again, it's always this continual debate of what is the county granted already, what is a real entitlement versus what the city has agreed to then honor from the county. You can see we're still having that debate about actual density levels that the county has entitled and the city promised to accept in the previous MOU from a couple of years ago. So that's still a debate to me. Others, it's not so much a debate. But now tell me your question again, Leslie, because that was the point leading to it. Please tell me again.
About you're just expressing allowing densities that could be sold off or transferred.
Oh, yes. So if we ever come to an agreement on what the county is really entitled, and yet the stormwater or other slope concerns or whatever environmental concerns, you know, perhaps limit those, and maybe, and again, I'm just throwing this out here, maybe those densities can be transferred to a TDR, transfer of development rights program, into our downtown area. We are seeking to revitalize our Main Street in downtown. We are bringing forth a community redevelopment area for the downtown that will have hopefully tax increment financing, perhaps. And again, this is just an idea. It hasn't been thoroughly discussed. We're trying to get there in the city council this year. But maybe some of those excess densities could be sold into this downtown area with a TDR program. So to me, that would be a win-win, but we still have a ways to go to get there.
So what were the original entitlements granted by Wasatch County?
It is a debate because it's been decades, literally, for some of these, and because the county has changed their code and the county has more performance matrices for amenities and landscaping, as well as their own stormwater, groundwater concerns, it's been a moving target. So some have master plans with actual entitlements. Some do not, but want to claim original vesting from years and years ago. To me, it's a moving target. It still has to be, I don't feel like it's set in stone, but that's my perception.
Yeah, I mean, are you guys headed to a lawsuit, though? I mean, usually things that have been approved are what are held up, and, you know, property rights.
I understand.
Strong state like
I
Utah.
I understand. But the point is that because the developers have had struggles, perhaps, with the county, now they're coming to the city and saying, this is what we have, and yet the county's saying, well, maybe they don't have it. What can I say? I'm sorry, I don't have a crystal ball on that.
Yeah. Other council members have said, as I mentioned, they're not concerned about approving the NVOZ because the city isn't approving an annexation. They're simply changing the zoning in the event of an annexation. Does that make a difference?
I don't think it makes a difference. It's really hard to say. We do have a North Village zone right now. But it has the density of 2 units per acre. So you can see the 2 units per acre that I had voted for originally, you know, for our annexation policy plan. You know, that's a lot different than the very high density that's being asked for now as annexations are pending. Councilmember Stack has assured me that he's not willing to vote for any of these annexations, even if this new NVOZ code passes. He's not willing to vote for the annexations until the stormwater plan is in place. I greatly appreciate that. He has backed up the private wellhead protection zones. I feel like these are minimum things we can do for the environment protections, but we still have that whole negotiation of actual densities that will happen in the actual annexation agreement. So there's still a lot to come.
Let's talk about the water. I mean, do we have enough water for 30,000 more people?
If you read that county groundwater study, they've measured, right, theoretically measured the hundreds of thousands of acre feet of water that's in our valley and where the sources are and who's using it at this point. I've always been assured by our city engineer that there is plenty of water, but of course it's in the agricultural areas, right, that would then be turned into municipal or urban development, which is supposedly less of a use than the agricultural use. Now, again, that's the generalities. That's what I've been told. We have drought. We know we all have drought. So it might be water on paper, but is there real water in the ground, right? Because the NBOS has been under the special service district with the county, that the county is providing water and sewer to this NBOS area. It won't be the city. It will be the county. The county has their own process for approving development just based on the water that the developer has. So the developer has to show to the County Water Board that they have 100% of the required water needed for their development before they can come to the city and get the building permits. So the county has their step there at the County Water Board to ensure that developers won't be able to develop. Even though they might be granted densities, they still won't be able to develop unless they have 100% of the water rights needed for their development.
Also wanted to ask you about the impacts on the school district. Are these being taken into consideration? I mean, are developers having to make the school land available?
The Sorenson annexation did provide the 60 acres, as I recall, dedicated to the school district. And I think that has already happened. It's already in the school district's hands. But the NBOS developers have not addressed that. And we as a city, we've not addressed that. I brought that up at the meeting last night, that we need collaboration with the school district for their needs, at least for land donations, to, you know, allow these higher density developments to contribute to the school district. And we really need that channel of communication and collaboration with the school district to know their needs and be able to help negotiate that, because if we don't, then it won't happen. Some developers in the past have donated to the school district, and they should be commended. But we as a city need to be on top of that for the school district.
Also, so when is Mr. Hardman back to take a vote?
Well, I'm going to be talking with him soon. I'm sure he's just under the weather right now, and I don't want to speak for him. He just wasn't able to, you know, give his input last night when that time came at about 10 o'clock or so. But, you know, we'll all be talking with him this week. I'm not sure what he'll want to do. He'll probably want to digest the public hearing, just as we all are. I'm hopeful that he will want to delay, but I can't speak for him.
Okay. So any idea, though, when this comes back then to the council?
Well, the city council is having their strategic yearly retreat this Friday and Saturday in our city. And I think it's going to be live. We're going to do a whole discussion of these kinds of issues and the overall growth in the city, our budget, our priorities, our goals, et cetera. So I'm sure it's going to come up this weekend. I hope that Mr. Hardman will feel well enough to join us, as well as all the other council members and staff. I'm sure that there will be quite a discussion this
all right.
weekend on that.
Okay. Heidi, anything else you want to add?
No, thank you okay. so much for your time. Happy New Year to all of you. Obviously, we've got a lot of challenges this year, and hopefully we can meet them and do well for our future.
All right. Heidi Franco, a member of the Heber City Council. Thank you. KPCW News Time now, 8:25. Park officials in Utah have said residents will see an increase in annual pass prices for state parks this year. The Salt Lake Tribune reporting that passes for visitors living in the state increased from $75 to $100. Senior passes increased from $30 to $50, marking the first increase in 25 years. The Utah Division of Annual Passes for residents outside the state rose earlier this year and will remain at $150. The statement attributed the rising cost to an increase in operating costs as well as visitation numbers. News Time, 8:27.
Support for KPCW is provided by the nonprofit Sundance Institute, presenting the Sundance Film Festival January 28th through February 3rd. Reimagined for 2021 to feature online screenings, filmmaker Q&As, talks, and more. While Park City will always be home, this year the Institute is looking forward to bringing festival audiences and artists together in new ways on its online platform. Tickets on sale January 7th. For more information, visit festival.sundance.org.
State officials in Utah have said that the state legislature is not expecting to divert education funding this year to pay for social programs that benefit children and people with disabilities, despite a voter-approved amendment allowing them to do so. The amendment allows the state to use income tax revenue, which used to be earmarked for education, organization to pay for some programs usually covered by sales tax money. KUER-FM is reporting that the Executive Appropriations Committee Chair, State Senator Jerry Stevenson, a Republican, said lawmakers do not need to use the financial flexibility this year. The legislature is scheduled to finalize the state budget during its general session, which starts January 19th. Well, the Bryce and Ronnie Athlete Snow Safety Foundation, known as Brass for Short, hosted a special screening of their film Off-Piste: Tragedy in the Alps last night and conducted a virtual panel discussion to help spread avalanche awareness. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more.
6 years ago Tuesday, the U.S. ski racing community lost two of its brightest rising stars. On January 5th, 2015, 19-year-old Bryce Astell and 20-year-old Ronnie Burlak were tragically killed in an avalanche while at a U.S. ski team training camp in the Austrian Alps. The Brass Foundation was founded in their honor in 2016 and aims to educate young skiers across the country about the dangers of avalanches, no matter where they are on the mountain. Bryce and Ronnie were skiing inbounds terrain when they lost their lives after heavy snowfall canceled training. Their deaths might have been avoided if they had the proper education and understood the differences in avalanche reporting and snow safety practices in different countries. January 5th has been declared Bryce and Ronnie Avalanche Safety Day by U.S. Ski and Snowboard, and the foundation commemorates the inaugural event with a screening of the Brass short film Off-Piste: Tragedy in the Alps. U.S. Ski and Snowboard Communications Manager Laura Carlton says the screening is followed with a panel discussion including local Olympic champion Ted Ligety.
In honor of the inaugural day, there's an online panel which features discussions with athletes and avalanche experts, including Park City area local Ted Ligety.
The film details the events leading up to the accident and includes education that could have prevented the tragedy. The film can also be viewed on the Brass website. Viewer discretion is advised as it does contain a dramatic reenactment of the accident as well as actual images of the aftermath. Since its founding, Brass has educated hundreds of ski clubs across the country and has trained thousands through its free Brass 101 introductory education program. In addition, Brass scholarships have provided national team athletes and coaches with certified on-snow safety training each spring. Every adult member of U.S. Ski and Snowboard must also take an online introductory safety training course. Brass has also successfully lobbied to add avalanche safety training to official coaching certification programs. More information on the Brass Foundation and Bryce and Ronnie Avalanche Safety Day can be found at brassavalanche.org. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Well, the Park City Council will meet for the first time of the year Thursday, starting in work session at 3 o'clock with a follow-up discussion on the Arts and Culture District. On the phone to preview the meeting, I have City Manager Matt Dias along with Deputy City Manager David Everett. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning. Good morning, Leslie.
So at 3 o'clock, a continued discussion on the Arts and Culture District and how to pay for it. David, maybe this is for you. A lot of people scratching their heads trying to figure out why the city pushed out a number of tax-generating businesses like the Maverick and Anaya's to now considering a tax increase in order to build a project that likely won't be nearly as profitable in terms of tax collection. So do we have a plan in place for the Arts and Culture District that it's going to be a revenue generator rather than a money spender?
Well, let me make sure I'm being clear with you and the listeners about what you just said. There is no proposal that includes any sort of tax increase at this time related to the Arts and Culture District development. It was always contemplated that the transient room tax and some supplemental sources from capital funds and operating funds would be used to fund the planning and construction of the Arts and Culture District from the city side. So that still is what is the plan right now, and there's no expectation at this moment that there would be any sort of other tax increase associated with that. So I just want to be super clear about that. In terms of whether the Arts and Culture District will generate revenue, the short answer is yes, it will. Will it generate revenue beyond what it will cost to run the Arts and Culture District? That we don't know for sure, but the expectation, I believe, has always been that it wasn't necessarily going to be a big revenue generator on site. Now, certainly the ancillary benefits that the city will feel from that kind of development in town, I think, will be incredibly catalytic, both to properties, in the area, in the Bonanza Park neighborhood, but certainly citywide when you think about having that as one major another major sort of activity generator and a place for people to be and a place that's an attractive part of town. So it's a little more diffuse in terms of what the economic impact will be in that respect, but certainly there's always been the expectation that this is going to be overall and in the long term a positive economic benefit to the city.
Okay, but are you still telling me though that there is some concern that the revenues won't meet the expenses of running the district?
I think there's always been the expectation that the that there would be some sort of city offset to expenses for running the district moving forward. You know, because this, it's a lot of city owned land, and that requires maintenance and operations and governance and all that kind of stuff. And so, at least initially, the expectation in my understanding has been that there's always going to be a city role there to help make sure the district runs well and is sustainable over time.
So where does that money come from then?
That's also coming from the transient room tax and maybe even some city operation funds. But again, nothing in the plans have ever called for additional like property tax, for instance, to be used for funding operations in the district. So there's always been the expectation that the transient room tax, which, you know, is certainly in the dumps right now, but in the next 5 to 10 years, we certainly expect it to come back in Park City to pre-COVID levels and beyond. Though there was always the expectation that some of that would be used for operations and maintenance at the district.
Okay.
And programming in particular as well, for what it's worth. You know, not just like, you know, removing snow, but also making sure that the plaza and the plaza level spaces are really activated and vibrant and an attractive place to be.
Right. But at first, the TRT dollars are being used to pay for the property, I mean, before we even build on it. So at what point is that $20 million paid off before you can start using it to operate it?
No, that's a good point there. So yes, the TRT was initially pledged in part for the purchase of the land there. And so I believe that was a 15-year bond. So there's another 11 years or so left on paying that aspect of the bond. But then in addition to the revenue from TRT used to pay the bond, there was additional revenue that exists and will exist that will be used to pay for the actual construction and then also support, like I said, some of the operations and programming moving forward.
So we're not using all of the TRT money to pay for the property. We're just using it to pay for the bond proceeds.
Well, yes, we're using part of what the TRT's annual revenue generated is to pay for that debt service. And then above and beyond that, there's still TRT available for these other costs for constructions and for programming operations.
Okay, got it. There's also a timeline when Sundance Institute and the Kimball Arts Center need to purchase their parcels, which will certainly help offset the cost of the property. So when's that?
Right, as we have it programmed out now, as proposed, and this is all, of course, subject to council approval and our partners, you know, completely agreeing to this approach, but as the way we've scheduled it out now, we anticipate a payment for the land and a transfer of the title of the parcels within the next year and a half. So we have a little bit of time to still work through that in terms of our cash flow scenario for construction.
So are these hard and fast deadlines, or is there wiggle room here?
Well, you know, what in this world is certain? And so I would say this would be the ideal schedule as we've worked through it in terms of, our cash flow. But we're absolutely willing to work with our partners and make sure that what works for us works for them and vice versa. And so, you know, there may be ways to structure payments. There may be ways to have more cash up front. I mean, there's different ways to go about it. So I guess the short answer is there's some flexibility there, and, you know, we continue to make sure that works with our partners.
Yeah, now, if both or either of them aren't able to live up to that timeline, do they lose the opportunity and the city moves on to something or someone else?
Well, ultimately, that's a decision, obviously, that the council and the partners, principals, would have to make. But at the end of the day, the city currently controls, owns all of that land. And, you know, we have letters of intent with Kimball and with Sundance that really spell out what the expectations are But, you know, in a very worst case scenario, if one of the partners came to the city and said, look, we just can't make it happen, the world's falling apart, you know, the city has certainly other options if that was to happen. I don't anticipate that being the case. I don't think that needs to even really be a serious consideration beyond, you know, just recognizing that the city certainly does have off-ramps if things really did fall apart, because at the end of the day, the city controls the land. And as our city manager likes to say, that is a big win from the get-go. So the city sits in a really, I think, beneficial place in terms of the community with regard to these parcels, because, you know, while they're there and we want to get them developed in terms of this plan that has been worked on for the last 4 to 5 years, at the end of the day, the city controls the land, and that's a great place to be in.
And the proposed housing that's going to go on site, what's the thinking for this? Do we build smaller for-rent units, or do we build larger for-sale units?
That first thing you said is exactly what we as staff are proposing, and the council will be really diving into at the meeting on Thursday. It's a bit of a shift for the city, and while the city does currently manage some rental units, they're mostly for city employees, and so this would be a shift to managing or a building and managing, even through a management company, of course, but managing rental units for residents that are not necessarily city employees. And so it's definitely a shift. We feel like it's actually a more sustainable model in terms of providing revenue that then helps build the next affordable housing project that the city works on. And it also meets a market demand that is seriously unmet at this point in Park City and the Park City area, which is, as you said, for smaller units, for rental units where it doesn't require a large down payment to get into housing. And it provides more flexibility, frankly, for the city moving forward, because we can adjust those the AMI requirements for those units based on what the community need is in the future. So if in, you know, if in 5 years it's like, wow, there's a big gap at the 60% area median income AMI, and then in 10 years it's like, wow, now the gap's at like 90%, you know, or 40%, the city can adjust based on that, which we don't really have that kind of flexibility when you do a for sale model that's deregistered.
Okay. And I guess, you know, we've got that 1,100 pillow building starting this year there out at the Canyons Village. And we have heard from some council members over the years about the need to build up the middle class. And I guess if that's the case, I mean, why aren't we building units for young families as opposed to young singles working in a tourist industry as opposed to the, you know, the teachers and the you know, first responders, the people that we want to stay here in our community and raise families?
Well, I think you need to, we view this element of the housing spectrum as certainly contributing to that. You know, there are a range of unit sizes that we're talking about between 400 and maybe 1,100 square feet. And sometimes those units, especially more in that middle range, that's enough for us, like a starting family, you know, a couple and a baby and an infant. Sure, it's not going to work maybe for a couple and a couple of kids who are in elementary school, but it's part of the spectrum that needs to be available so people can actually get into the housing world here in Park City and be part of the community. And I think it's actually really contributes to that sense of community, because you do have more of a spectrum represented and a spectrum present in the city, as opposed to only people who can afford to be in a two-bedroom single-family home, right? So it does provide more opportunity for people to start to really integrate into the community, and it meets a need that really is not very well met right now in Park City.
Okay, so it's really just our definition of small. I mean, I think if small is 200, 250 square feet, we're not talking that small, huh?
Not necessarily, no. I think our smallest unit that we're talking about currently for the Arts and Culture District, at least, is about 400 square feet. Like I said, I think they'll go up to either 900 or 1,100 square feet as well, you know. And 900 square feet is, that's room for a couple at a minimum. And, you know, again, I could see small starting out families having a place there too in certain ways.
Oh, yeah. I've lived in a 600-square-foot house,
yeah,
that's screened in with this screen, right, to get that 600 square feet with three people. So yeah, it works. Let's see, so what are you hoping out of this meeting then? I mean, some kind of decision? Is just really just some background here, and what happens?
This is our returning to the council with information and further supplemental background work that we did based on what the council's questions were in our two meetings that we had back in December, a little less than a month ago. And so we really are not expecting a decision by the council on Thursday at all. It's really just a space for them to continue to flesh out their questions and concerns and for us to respond to them based on what we've heard and what we expect to hear. And so the expectation is also that we would have another work session on the 14th of January and maybe a decision at that point. Although, again, I think the goal here is to not pressure the council into making a decision at all. It's to provide them with all the resources they need to make that decision comfortably. So we have a lot of space on the agenda on Thursday, and we'll do so on the 14th as needed.
Okay. Let's turn it to Matt. Matt, the council will get an update on the renewable energy project for city operations. How are we doing here? I mean, 2022 is like a year from now, yet the 8-megawatt solar project under construction won't even be done until the late fall of 2022.
Well, I think just to take a step back, I think, we're tremendously excited, to be quite honest. So the project is currently under construction in Tooele County, an 80 megawatt solar farm, and we've had just amazing collaboration with Rocky Mountain Power, Summit County, Salt Lake City, both of our resorts, and Utah Valley. And so out of all of our critical priorities that the city has, this is the one that we have just in the shortest amount of time made the most progress on. And so the goal here is by the end of 2022, we will be sourcing the entire city's municipal footprint through this solar farm down in the valley. And this is just unprecedented work on behalf of the state of Utah, quite frankly, the Public Service Commission, the public utilities, Rocky Mountain Power, and cities and towns. And so staff is reporting in to council because for the first time, the project is underway and it's under construction, and we're just tremendously excited about it.
All right. Also, you'll be checking in with council to let them know about suspending enforcement of city code in response to the pandemic. We're allowing temporary signs. There's no construction embargoes during what would be Sundance, basically letting businesses operate outside their buildings. Because what I see every morning is we've got kind of a construction parking area on the top of China Bridge. So we're allowing construction companies to meet and pick up their employees there?
Yeah, I mean, if they, we obviously have some free parking during the day in China Bridge until 5 p.m. And we also have a permit parking program in China Bridge. But, just to take a step back, the municipality throughout the COVID pandemic has, tried to wring every efficiency or every customer service improvement that we can possible to support our local businesses and nonprofits and those struggling in our community. And so, it's some of these measures about relaxing our sign codes and relaxing enforcement and relieving late fees. A lot of those can be done by myself administratively through the authority granted me by the council and mayor. However, we like to come in and report this in a public meeting and be transparent about it, because if business owners or nonprofits or residents quite frankly have an idea or they have a problem, we want them, if they see something, we want them to say something. So we're trying to provide multiple opportunities to share the sort of buffet line of improvements that we're making to support local businesses, residents, and nonprofits. Often as we can, kind of at every opportunity, in order to continue to support people that are struggling with the pandemic.
Okay. Hey, I've got to leave it there. David, Matt, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
Well, tickets to the 2021 Sundance Film Festival go online tomorrow. On the phone with details, Managing Director and CFO of the Institute, Betsy Wallace, good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Well, give us a quick recap of what's happening starting January 28th. We've got a shorter festival, really an online festival.
We do indeed. We ended up, with COVID coming on and it's been a tough year trying to figure out how the festival could at all be live. We've been really working with the state of Utah and Summit County and Park City and trying to understand how this all could come together. And we came to a conclusion very quickly that in-person just was not going to be the route for us this year. And it's a sad statement, but we want to make sure that residents, staff, artists, everyone is safe. So that decision was made early on. And we pivoted fairly quickly into developing a online platform. And really the purpose, Leslie, is to make sure the mission of the organization stays intact. And the mission, one side is developing artists and finding wonderful voices, and the other side is to ensure that those voices and those films are shown to audiences in Utah and around the world. So the way to do that for us and to stay active this year was to create this online platform for us. So yes, we go live on around 6, I think it's 6 p.m. Mountain. We're doing all of our times in Mountain Time in honor of Park City and Sundance, and Park City and Utah and Summit County. And we start with CODA, and then we have our full slate of premieres, which primarily go through the entire weekend. And then we have two premieres on Monday and two premieres on Tuesday, with being interspersed with on-demand windows that allow people to see movies that they may not have seen. And then Tuesday night is our awards night, and Wednesday is our award winner day.
Okay, so this year, given that it's online, can anyone who wants a ticket get a ticket, unlike prior festivals?
Well, yeah, right. The prior festivals, we were really limited by the size of the theater. So this year, it is definitely a little bit more expansive, but we still have caps. And the caps are more, or allow us to have more people to watch films, but the caps are set by film, and they're set by the filmmakers or whoever owns the rights of those films, and right now it's usually the filmmakers. So we have to live and abide by those. So those are what set the amount of tickets available. But I remind people that as you see something online, and many times it's just not yourself watching these films. It might be your family or your kids or however you're going to celebrate Sundance in a very safe fashion. So those extra pair of eyeballs don't affect our cap set by the film right holders, but it does allow us to have, I think it's going to be a great way of experiencing the festival and a great way to stay safe. So we're excited about it.
Yeah. So how do people participate then? I mean, it's not going to be like the onslaught we've seen again in years past where people try to get, you know, logged in and in line.
Well, you know, yeah, it's a great question. So tomorrow we go on sale for our public tickets. And tickets, you know, it's a broader word of tickets. It's individual screen tickets. We have new products for passes. So we have a full festival pass, and we have a one-day pass. And those passes allow you to go online, reserve a ticket for a premiere, should you wish, or if you want to wait for them to come into the on-demand windows, which really start for public on Saturday, that you have the ability to see them at your own leisure versus a premiere which has a slotted time. I would suggest that people get online fairly quickly tomorrow and really experience and see how the platform looks. The best thing to do, though, is get online today if you haven't already done so, set up your account, and then tomorrow when you go forth, you don't have to stumble around setting up your account. You've already got it ready and you're ready to go, and you can figure out what you want. And then the other piece, Leslie, is really to spend some time looking at the online schedule and program and note which ones are your favorite, so that when you go online tomorrow, the next step you would do is to convert that favorite, should you want to see that movie, into a reservation. And it's really just getting you a ticket for a premiere, should you wish. But it's the best way to do it.
All right, so is it still $20 a show or a film?
No, we got it down to $15, which we're excited about. And it's really trying to make sure that we become more accessible throughout the United States and where possible. Most of our films are going to be geo-blocked to the U.S. But we're just trying to make sure that we can get those films out and those voices heard as best as possible, Leslie. So that's our goal.
All right. You announced last week that you would not be opening up the Ray Theater again just due to the safety concerns. So regarding the other satellite locations, I mean, the Institute had said it would make a case-by-case decision for those satellite spots. I mean, I think there's 33 or so other spots around the country. Do we cancel all of those, or are we? How are we choosing
to...
No, which ones to keep?
So the way it works is that that is really up to the, in many cases, it's up to the regulations within that town, within that county, within that state. And we've been working with everyone trying to understand where COVID is and how to really make sure their patrons are safe. It's interesting, most of the satellite screens in the South are going to be in drive-ins. So as long as drive-ins are open and people want to go, that's one route. As you get farther north and it gets colder and colder, you know, to Park City, that becomes a little bit more difficult. So those are really the satellite screens that we've been talking to and we'll continue to talk to see if we need to move those into, you know, a piece of where they cannot show, they cannot have anybody in.
Yeah. So will there be any screenings in Utah then? I mean, at maybe the Sundance Resort or the Salt Lake Film Society in Salt Lake?
Yeah, no, there is not for for our public. It's you know, we're looking for 2022 and hoping that we can get everybody healthy and everybody who wants to be vaccinated and we can, you know, kick this COVID in, you know, where and really be able to come back together. But we do have a partnership with Utah Film Center and with Salt Lake Film Society. And for Utah Film Center, they're going to help us with kids and online presentation and programming for kids films that are within our selection. And then Salt Lake Film Society is also doing some online talks and events that will be hosting Utah artists and organizations. So I strongly recommend reaching out to both of those because I think, you know, they're wonderful organizations and we love our partnership with them, so they'll do a great job.
Yeah, you have been leasing the Ray Theater there at the Holiday Village. How long does that contract go through? I mean, are you giving that up altogether or?
No, not at all. We are in a 5-year contract with them, but we have the ability to extend for 2 5-year periods. So in essence, it's a 15-year contract with that theater. It's a great theater for us. We invested a lot of money in it, and we'd love to be able to open it next year. Time will tell. But I think, you know, when we think about Utah, we have a lot of things that are happening this year for Utah, and we're trying to make sure that we can have a free screening of Life in a Day, a great film, distributing free and discounted tickets and passes for kids or youth that are 18 to 25 through Utah colleges and universities and many local community organizations around the state. We're working with high schools and trying to provide young adults, you know, below 18, appropriate films that teachers can either have show it within the school, within a schoolroom, or to show it on the portal that they use when they're teaching classes. And that allows for the kids to have a discussion with the teacher, and we're excited about that. So we have a lot of things set up for Utah, and we're excited about that.
Okay, I got just a couple of minutes and a lot to get through here. So do we have any kind of Townie Tuesday screening happening?
Yeah, well, we're working very hard on that. So I hope to have something to announce over the next couple weeks on that one. We still have 3 weeks to go, so we're working to see how we can set that up. It's something near and dear to my heart. You know, I've been in Utah or Park City for 20 years, and I remember lining up in the Gateway Building, you know, all overnight, basically, trying to get tickets. So it's something that I'm really excited about trying to have happen, and so we're working hard on that one.
And will we have some sort of online version of an opening press conference?
Well, we're going to have an opening for sure. It is our first film starts at 6 p.m. on the 28th, Thursday. It's Coda, which is a great film around a child that is the only hearing person within a family. Right before that, there will be a just an opening ceremony really from Tabitha Jackson. And Tabitha Jackson, you know, fabulous step in for John Cooper. She's just really taken this onto her own. She has a great vision of where we're going. And she's going to start us off, kick us off. So so look for that time when you go online. You'll see if you are able to make it. It's going to be fun, I think.
Yeah, and we had hoped that John Cooper would have a presence as the director emeritus for the 40th anniversary. Does he have any role in any of this then? Just give
Well, you know, we're hoping he's going to pop in and do some daily shows along Main Street. And we just, as some people may know, we've just put up the banners for Sundance. We don't want people to forget about us. We're excited to have Park City be our home, and we've worked with the Egyptian to utilize their marquee, which has been a great partnership with us with the Egyptian. And the concept is that the morning kickoff show, many of them will have John Cooper here interviewing people or participating somewhere in Park City.
And then quickly, the future for the Arts and Culture District. We had just heard from the city. There's a timeline about having to move forward with their partners. Robert Redford just sold Sundance Resort. He's got cash in pocket. Do you think he's going to put some of that into the new Park City headquarters?
Well, I think that's Mr. Redford's money. So the headquarters that we have here would be through the Sundance Institute, a nonprofit. So we have a capital campaign that has been put on hold because of COVID. We were very forthright and transparent with the city about that. But our focus right now is really trying to get through this festival and see how we do. This has been a huge pivot for this company, and we're very excited about it. But it's a different fiber for us to pull and expand on for our staff, and they're doing a fabulous job. I'm so proud of them all. And we're ready to go. And again, tomorrow at noon, Mountain Time, people pop on to festival.sundance.org, and I hope they find films that they enjoy and they can experience with their loved ones. But the long term is we want to come back and we want to be here, and we're hoping that 2022 allows us to step back in at some level that makes it, you know, back to that community aspect and being able to talk to artists.
Okay. Hey, Betsy, I'm out of time. Thanks for yours. That's Betsy Wallace, Managing Director of Sundance Institute. You've been listening to the local news hour here on KPCW Park City. Stay tuned. We've got headline news followed by the Mountain Life. It's 9 o'clock.